The edge. The ocean in 1519 was not blue. It was black. Black as ink. Black as rumor. Black as the space between the stars where God had not yet spoken light into existence. A man stands at the rail of a wooden ship called the Trinidad. Salt has cracked his knuckles raw. Wind whips his graying beard. He stares west into darkness. Darkness no European has crossed. Ferdinand Magellan. Fernão de Magalhães, in Portuguese. Hernando de Magalhães, in Spanish. Two names for a man caught between two worlds. He's 40 years old. Not young, not naive, not romantic about what waits beyond that horizon. He has seen blood in Morocco, watched men die for inches of sand that meant nothing the next morning. He has been dismissed by his own king, called a traitor for suggesting a western route to the Spice Islands. King Manuel told him no. So Magellan crossed into Spain, a Portuguese captain commanding a Spanish fleet, leading 270 men toward a horizon most believed hid the sea monsters, or hid the sea devils, or nothing at all, just an endless fall off the lip of creation. Five ships rock in the harbor behind him, the Trinidad, the San Antonio, the Concepcion, the Victoria, and the Santiago. Wooden fortresses loaded with hardtack and hope. 270 men who signed contracts knowing half of them won't return. And one idea, singular and obsessive and dangerous. There must be a western passage to the Spice Islands. Nah, the map says it doesn't exist. The priests say God forbids it. The captains say, man, it's suicide. Magellan, standing tall, doesn't care. Because men who make history are willing to be wrong. Men who change the world need to be right. The wind fills the sails. Behind him, Europe slowly fades. The cathedrals, the cobblestones, church bells marking hours that just don't matter anymore. Ahead lies a world where no map is drawn. Lands that no priest has blessed. People with no king that hasn't been named. In 6 months, everything he knows will be shattered. In 6 months, the impossible somehow becomes routine. In 6 months, he'll find a passage through the bottom of the world. But first, the crossing. The ships turn west. The ocean seems to swallow them whole. The journey south. September 1519. They sail south along the coast of Brazil. The crew is already breaking. Not from storms, not from monsters, from monotony. The same horizon, the same black and gray water. The same hardtack that crumbles like ash in your mouth. The same salt pork that's tough as boot leather. The same wine that soured. The same water that grows things like algae that you can see. And the captains? The captains hate Magellan. Juan de Cartagena, Spanish nobleman, captain of the San Antonio, challenges Magellan openly. Where is this strait? Portugal? Magellan doesn't answer because he doesn't know. He just believes with everything in him. By December, they've passed the furthest point any European has ever sailed. every map that they have is now useless. Every chart is blank. They're navigating by intuition and pure stubbornness. The coast grows wild. Mountains rising from the sea. Forests so thick, sunlight dies before reaching the ground. Water so cold they could kill you in a matter of minutes. And then the storms. Not the storms that they were used to, not normal storms. Southern hemisphere storms that spin the wrong direction and tear sails away like paper. Waves that are three stories high. Wind that continually screams. And the Santiago is lost. Smashed against rocks in the darkness. 24 men swim for shore. Somehow, they survive. They walk 50 miles north through wilderness to rejoin the fleet. But the ship is gone. Only four ships remain. By March 1520, they reach Patagonia, the coast of Argentina. Empty, wind-scoured, beautiful in a way that makes you almost lonely. They anchor in a bay Magellan names Puerto San Julián. They've been sailing for 6 months. The men are exhausted and supplies are running low. And the captains, they're done waiting. April 1st, 1520, Easter Sunday. Juan de Cartagena leads a mutiny. Three ships side with the mutineers. Three captains demand Magellan turn back. They have 40 sailors with swords and crossbows. But Magellan has loyalty, experience, and ruthlessness. He sends a boat to the Victoria carrying supplies. The mutineers allow it to dock. Five of Magellan's men board carrying wine barrels. The wine barrels each contained armed soldiers. They kill the Victoria's captain in 30 seconds and they take the ship back. Cartagena and the other mutineers surrender within an hour. Magellan has two options, mercy or example. He chooses example. The ringleader is beheaded, then quartered. His body parts displayed on gibbets along the shore. Cartagena and the priests who blessed the mutiny, they're marooned. Left on the beach with supplies for 1 week. No one ever sees them again. No one ever hears from them. This is the man who will circumnavigate the globe, the visionary, the tyrant, maybe both. But something happens in Patagonia. Something that changes the way Magellan sees the world. Something no one in Europe will even believe. The wonders. Late March 1520. That's when they find the footprints. Esteban Bosque Poussin, 6 feet tall, built like an oak, is walking the shoreline when he just stops, staring into the sand. Doesn't move for 30 seconds. He runs. Now he sprints back to camp. 20 sailors gather in a semicircle, just staring. Nobody speaking. The footprint. The footprint is 18 inches long. 10 to 12 inches wide. Pressed so deep into the wet sand that water fills it like a small pond. Antonio Salomon? Well, that's the ship's carpenter. He pulls off his boot. He places it inside the footprint. His boot looks like a children's toy, like a child's shoe. An 18-inch footprint belongs to someone they know, 10 feet tall. Not 8 feet, 10 feet tall. And there are more. There are more tracks leading inland. Into forests where trees grow so close, sunlight dies before reaching the ground. Magellan follows with 10 men. half a mile inland, the tracks stop at a clearing. They find a fire pit. Stones arranged in a perfect circle, each stone weighing 60 pounds. And in the center, ash, still warm. Beside the fire, bones. Guanaco bones. The femurs snap clean in half lengthways. No tool marks, just broken. Like somebody broke them with their hands. That night, Magellan doubles the watch because something is living here. Something big. And tomorrow it comes. 2 days later, at dawn, a figure appears on the beach. Alone and absolutely enormous. Antonio Pigafetta, an Italian scholar, 25, was documenting the voyage, and he writes, "This man was so tall that the tallest among us reached only his waist. Esteban, 6 feet tall, reaches this man's waist. Hair black as wet stone, and it hangs to his shoulders. It's thick as rope. Woven with shells and feathers, skin the color of burnished copper. Dark, polished, the color of metal that's been worked and heated. Shoulders broader than a draft horse, arms hanging relaxed at its sides. Each hand the size of a serving platter. Fingers as thick as broom handles. Legs like columns, feet bare on the sand. 18 inches long. 6 toes on each foot, not 5, 6. His eyes are amber, not brown, not hazel, but amber, like honey held to sunlight, yellow-brown, but with depth, colors within colors. He takes one step forward, and it seems like the ground shakes, 20 feet away now. Magellan steps forward, hands empty, palms out. I mean no harm. The giant tilts his head and studies him, then raises his own hand, palm out, mirroring the gesture. And then he speaks. His voice is low and deep and resonant, like stones grinding at the bottom of a well. Words nobody understands, but the tone. It was not aggression. It wasn't threat. It was simply curiosity. He's curious about what these tiny men with their tiny boats are doing. Magellan points to himself. Ferdinand. The giant watches, then points to his own chest and says something like, Koroth. The first giant Ferdinand Magellan ever met has a name. And that's when everything changes. Because monsters don't have names. People do. For 6 days, they live among the giants. 3 days later, Koroth leads them inland to a settlement. 40 lodges scattered across a green valley. Each one massive, 40 feet long, 25 feet high, built from split logs and hides. Doors 12 feet tall. And everywhere there's people. Giants. Men and women and children going about their day like this is normal, because for them it was. The children are 6 to 7 feet tall, running between lodges and playing, laughing with voices too deep for their age. He witnessed a child fall, skin his knee. Starts crying. His mother, 9 feet tall, scoops him up like he weighs nothing, kisses the knee. The child stops crying, runs back to his friends. The same gesture mothers make everywhere Magellan has been. They watch the giants live. Women weaving baskets 6 feet tall. Men splitting logs with stone axes. Children learning to control their strength, wrestling carefully, testing their power. One afternoon, a giant child approaches Esteban. 7.5 feet tall, gangly, wants to play. So they play tag. When the child tags Esteban, Esteban goes flying. The child's face collapses. I heard him. But Esteban gets up laughing, tags the child back. Relief floods through the child's face. An hour of a 7-foot child learning to be gentle with a 6-foot man. On the fifth day, Karath leads them deeper into the forest, points south, makes a gesture, hands held low, knee height, making himself smaller. They walk for an hour. The ancient forest. Trees still old, the bark has turned silver. Trunks 20 feet around. Canopy blocking the sun completely. The giants move very carefully here. Quietly, respectful. They stop at a clearing, a natural clearing, 60 feet across, one shaft of sunlight breaking through. On the far side is a village. Tiny, small structures built from woven branches no bigger than doghouses. And from the structures come people. Small people. The tallest one stood about 3 foot tall. The shortest about 20 inches tall. Perfectly proportional. Not children, not deformed, just small. Giants 10 feet tall, humans 5.5 feet tall, and these people 3 foot tall. The math somehow was broken. Or maybe we're just somewhere in the middle. One of them approaches, an old man, white hair, white beard, braided into 3 small braids. Face creased with 70 years of hard life. Eyes sharp as obsidian. He's wearing clothing made from woven grass, intricate work, beautiful craftsmanship. He walks right up to Magellan. Doesn't stop until he's standing at Magellan's feet. Has to tilt his head back, and I'm talking all the way back, 3 feet tall, looking up at 5'8". He reaches up with one hand. His hand is the size of a Spanish silver dollar. 3 fingers and a thumb. Not 4 fingers like humans, but 3. He touches Magellan's boot. Pats it twice. Testing, is this real? Then he looks up at Magellan's face and he studies him and he laughs. Not in a mocking way or not nervous, just amused. At the ridiculous idea that God made people in 3 different sizes. It's like a cosmic joke at scale. At the sheer absurdity of existence. And then the other pygmies laugh, coming out of their dwellings, high voices, musical, like bells. And the sailors laugh, because at this point, how can you not? And the giants laugh, those deep, rumbling, gentle, thunder-like voices. For 30 seconds in a clearing in Patagonia in 1520, 3 species that shouldn't coexist are laughing together at the same joke. The joke being, God has a bigger imagination than we thought. Now they stay until sunset. The pygmies show them their village, each dwelling a work of art. Woven branches bent into perfect domes. Inside spaces perfectly sized for 3-foot people. One pygmy woman offers Pigafetta a gift, a basket the size of a thimble, woven so tightly it holds water. Hours of work in something so small. Pigafetta takes it, has to pinch it with 2 fingers. It disappears into his palm and he cries. He cries right there. Cries because something this beautiful exists and no one in Europe is going to believe it. The giants protect the pygmies from predators. The pygmies show the giants where medicine is and how plants grow. Symbiosis. Not between the species, between scales. An ecosystem that makes no sense by European logic but works perfectly here. When they leave, the old man walks them to the clearing's edge, raises his tiny hand, palm out. Safe travels, middle-sized ones. And Magellan realizes the world is not what they taught him in Lisbon. It's not even close. The Passage. Early August 1520, they leave Patagonia. 40 giants come to the shore to see them off. Caroth is in front, raises his hand, palm out. Some sailors wave back, calling out the few giant words that they had learned. Kelon, friend. Esteban is crying, silent tears. Magellan watches the shore disappear. Knows no one in Europe is going to believe him. Kings don't believe in giants. Priests don't believe in pygmies. The charts don't have room for people who shouldn't exist. But he learned they do exist. And that changes everything about what's possible. They sail south for weeks, searching, always searching. The coast grows wild, mountains rising from the sea like teeth, glaciers having massive chunks of ice falling into the water, water so cold that it could kill you in minutes. August 21st, 1520. They find it. A narrow channel, barely wide enough for the ships. Walls of rock rising straight from water like God carved a path through the stone. And there it was, the strait. It takes 38 days to navigate. 38 days of threading ships through channels where one mistake means sinking. Walls so close that you can touch them. Currents pulling you into the rocks. Winds that change direction without warning. The men have visions, seeing demons in the rock walls, hearing voices in the wind. The priest prays prayers no one else even listens to anymore. At night, they see fires on the southern shore, hundreds and hundreds of fires. The natives, watching them pass. Magellan names it Tierra del Fuego. Translation, Land of Fire. The San Antonio deserts. Turn back in the night. Takes 55 men and most of the supplies. Three ships remain. The Trinidad, the Concepcion, and the Victoria. And then, November 1st, 1520. They emerge into an ocean so calm, it looks like glass. Water so blue, it looks impossible. Deep blue, azure, cobalt. The blue you see in paintings and think the artist exaggerated. But they didn't. This blue exists. Water so still you can see clouds reflected on the surface. A perfect mirror, heaven and ocean that touch. No waves, no current pulling them along, no ice grinding against the hulls. Just open water stretching to the edge of sight. The temperature is warm, actually warm. For the first time in 2 months, warmth, and it felt great, gentle warmth. Like spring sunshine after a long winter. Magellan stands at the rail of the Trinidad, stares west into the water that stretches forever. And he whispers, El Mar Pacifico. The Pacific, the peaceful sea, he named it. Right there, named an entire ocean. The largest body of water on Earth. Named it for what it felt like in that perfect moment when peace replaced chaos. After 6 months of sailing into darkness, after 38 days of threading through frozen hell, after mutinies and starvation and cold, after all of that, this. Calm, still, and peaceful. The crews stand on deck, some crying, some laughing, some praying. Some glad they made it. Through the impossible strait into an ocean no European has ever sailed. They don't know how the Pacific is three times larger than they think. Don't know 98 days will pass before they see land again. Don't know how 19 men will die of scurvy. Don't know Magellan has only 6 months to live. But right now, they've won. The Crossing. November 1520. They sail west. For 98 days, they sail west. 98 days without seeing land. 98 days of the same empty horizon. 98 days of supplies running out. By December, the food is gone. They're eating the leather from their rigging, soaking it in seawater for days just to soften it, then roasting it over coals. It tastes like ash and salt and desperation. They're eating sawdust mixed with water, making a paste that fills your stomach without nourishing anything in your body. They're eating rats, the ones that survived in the hold. Sailors bid on them. A rat costs half a ducat. That's more expensive than chicken in Spain. By January, scurvy sets in. Your gums swell first, then they start to turn black. Your teeth loosen in their sockets, and they start falling out one by one. Your joints in your body ache. Old wounds that healed years ago reopen spontaneously. Blood seeping through the skin for no reason at all. Your mind starts going insane. You see things. Islands that aren't there. Ships on the horizon that disappear when you look directly at them. Voices calling your name from below deck. And inevitably, men start dying. One every few days at first. Then one every day. Then multiple per day. They wrap them in canvas, weight them with stones, say prayers that sound hollow, and drop them overboard. Watch them sink into the water so deep their bones will never be found. Pigafetta writes, "We ate biscuit no longer, biscuit but powder of biscuit, swarming with worms. It stank strongly of rat urine. We drank yellow water that had been putrid for many days. We also ate the ox hides from the yards, and we ate the rats." Some men, unable to bear their affliction, just died. February 1521, 90 days since they saw land, 19 men dead, the rest barely alive. And then, March 6th, 1521. Land. An island. Green, tropical, beautiful island. The crew can barely stand. Their legs don't work right after 98 days at sea. They stumble. They just stumble onto the beach and they fall to their knees and they kiss the sand. And natives? Oh, there's natives. They bring food. Fresh fruit and fish. Water that doesn't taste like death. Some sailors eat too fast and they die from their stomachs rebelling after months of starvation. But most survive, slowly regaining strength, learning to walk again, learning to eat again. They stay for 3 days, then they sail west again, island hopping through the Philippines. And that's where the story should end. Magellan should sail home. Claim his glory. Prove the earth is round. Retire wealthy and die old. But you see, that's not what happens. Mactan. April 1521. The Philippines. Magellan is no longer just an explorer. He's become a missionary, a warrior, a colonizer. He's befriended local chiefs, converted some to Christianity. He's made alliances and made enemies. One chief refuses to submit, Lapu-Lapu, leader of the Mactan Island. Magellan tells him to accept Spanish rule, to accept Christianity, and to accept European authority. Lapu-Lapu says no. April 27th, 1521. Dawn. Magellan takes 60 men to Mactan. Fully armored, crossbows, swords, and muskets against 1,500 warriors. His officers say, "We should not go. Do not go. Tell him to send other men. Tell him his life is too valuable to risk." But Magellan has spent his entire life proving himself, proving he's not too old, proving that he's not too crippled from Morocco, not too Portuguese to command Spanish men. And he thinks he's come too far to turn back now. They'll land at dawn. The coral reef prevents the ships from getting close. Magellan and 60 men wade through chest-deep water toward the beach. 1,500 warriors wait on shore. The battle begins. Crossbow fire, muskets discharged, some warriors fall, but there are simply too many. They swarm forward, spears, swords, shields made from wood and rattan. Magellan's armor is heavy, 40 pounds of metal in tropical heat and water. He can barely move. His men start retreating, running for the boats. Magellan covers their retreat and fights. Kills two warriors, wounds three more. A spear hits Magellan's leg, the bad leg. The one wounded in Morocco, the one that's never healed right. He stumbles, but he doesn't fall. He keeps fighting. Another spear hits his arm. His sword falls. He's now surrounded. Warriors closing in. Seven of his men try to reach him, but they die trying. A warrior swings a sword and catches Magellan's face. He falls. He falls into water that's 2 feet deep, face down. They don't stop. Spears strike his back, his leg, his neck. Again and again and again. Until he stops moving. Ferdinand Magellan dies in 2 feet of tropical water, face down, at 41 years old. Killed by men defending their home from invaders, his body is never recovered. The warriors keep it as a trophy. No grave, no monuments, no funeral. Just water and blood and the end of everything that he built. The expedition continues without him. Juan Sebastian Elcano takes command. The Trinidad is too damaged to sail. They abandon her. The Conception is burned for parts. Two ships become one, the Victoria, and the Victoria limps home across the Indian Ocean, around Africa, north through the Atlantic. September 6, 1522, 3 years after leaving Spain, the Victoria enters Seville Harbor. One ship out of five. 18 men out of 270. Ferdinand Magellan is not among them. But they completed the circle. They proved the earth is round. They named an ocean. They found a passage. They changed history as we know it. Without the man who made it possible. The edge of the world. Here's what haunts us about Ferdinand Magellan. He knew the cost. Every morning he stood at that rail staring west into uncertainty. He knew men would die. He knew that he might die. And yet, he sailed anyways. Not because he was fearless. Because he believed that some things were worth dying for. Worth killing for. Worth destroying yourself and others for. He believed that mattering, even briefly, even violently, even controversially, was better than safety. Maybe he was right, maybe he was wrong. Maybe the men who died in the Pacific would have preferred to grow old in Spain, watching their children grow up instead of being wrapped in canvas and dropped into the water so deep their bones will never be found. Maybe the sailors who turned back with the San Antonio made the wiser choice. Survival over glory. Life over legacy. But maybe, just maybe, there is something in the human soul that needs more than just survival. That needs to know, did I do something impossible? Did I go further than I was supposed to. Did I matter? Magellan answered those questions with his life and his death. He literally bent geography. He reshaped the map of human possibility. He proved the world was one world, not a collection of isolated fragments. He met giants. He met pygmies living in a harmony and carried that wonder with him across an ocean he named for peace. He found a passage through the bottom of the earth. He sailed further than any European ever had in the history of the world. And he died in 2 feet of water, trying to plant a flag on land that didn't want him. Every time you look at a globe spinning in a classroom, every time you trace your finger around the southern tip of South America and wonder what it must have felt like to navigate that frozen labyrinth, every time you fly across the Pacific in 6 hours and think about the men who crossed it in 98 days, eating strap leather and sawdust, every time you see the word Pacific without thinking about the man who named it, you echo Ferdinand Magellan, a man who stood at the edge of the world, a man who was told no and sailed anyway, a man who chose wonder over safety, a man who met giants and learned humility, a man who named an ocean, a man who died before the story even ended. And now you know the rest of the story. Thanks for listening. This is Mr. Hansen. This has been the story about Ferdinand Magellan. Fascinating. Come and join us over at MrHansenPodcast.com. That's MrHansenPodcast.com. Get alerted to new things coming out, and it's free to be a member. Members only content. I'll see you there. MrHansenPodcast.com.